Getting an education behind bars has been shown to decrease recidivism and disruptive behavior. But in Illinois, that's much easier said than done. And for aging LGBT individuals, finding the right care can be daunting. A new workshop aims to give nurses the tools and education needed to care for elderly members of the queer community. But first, the ACLU of Illinois has filed a lawsuit against six police officers who mistakenly arrested a Black Eastern Illinois University student while he was traveling with his swim team. We hear from him about how the whole experience has affected his life.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Maxey. Coming up later this hour, what it takes to get an education behind bars? Patience. Years and years of patience. But first, last February, the Eastern Illinois University swim team was traveling back home after a championship meet in South Dakota. They stopped at a rest stop in East Moline, just over the Illinois border in the Quad Cities. The teammates got off the bus to stretch their legs, including Jalen Butler, the only Black student on the team. Moments after he walked away from the charter bus to take a selfie, he heard sirens and was approached by the police. He dropped to the ground, and officers pressed his face into the snow and pointed a gun to his head. It was all a big mistake, and now the ACLU of Illinois has filed a lawsuit against the six officers involved, alleging Jalen Butler was the victim of unlawful search and seizure, false arrest, and excessive force, among other charges. Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines spoke with Jalen Butler to learn what happened to him that night and how his life has been affected by the whole experience.
So we had pulled over.
Jalen, you were on the way back from a swim competition, correct?
Yes, we're on our way back from our conference championship meet last year from South Dakota. And then we were making our trip back, and that's when we had stopped. We had about 3 hours left of the trip. So, you know, it was indeed time to get some food in us and to make those last 3 hours. So when we stopped, it was kind of hot on the bus. So we all kind of got off, stretched our legs a little bit, got some fresh air from being crammed on the bus for so long. Afterwards, I was asked if I could take a picture with the sign just a little bit in front of the bus. We had been doing stuff like that the entire trip, just kind of taking pictures of like landmark signs or stuff like that to keep the parents and people back here on campus updated about our travel back and where we were. Next thing, after I took the picture, I took maybe about a couple steps, and then there were just a line of police officers, SUVs, cars racing down the highway on the same side as our bus. And they immediately came to a complete stop and then jumped out with their guns drawn, shouting and yelling. And I really reacted on the way I knew how to, was just thinking back to what I was taught. And that was to, don't give, police officers any reason to assume that you have anything. So just do everything and comply before they even have to ask of you to do that. So that was, getting on my knees, emptying my hands if I had anything in them, which I did at the time was my phone. So I dropped my phone immediately, got down on my knees and put my hands in the air and kind of just waited. And then once they got to me, that's when the situation kind of escalated, kind of realized that they were a little more anxious with the situation. And I was a little confused on what was going on.
I imagine. What were the officers actually doing to you and saying to you in this moment?
So they were being a little bit aggressive. One officer had his knee in my lower back, another with his knee on my upper my neck. I was being handcuffed. I was on the ground, laid down, trying to express that I was on the swim team. I kept saying, I'm on the swim team, on EIU swim team. My bus is right over there. I kept trying to get them to understand that I was on the swim team and that I couldn't have possibly done anything wrong. After I said all that, another officer kind of knelt down beside me and placed his handgun up to my forehead and told me that if I kept moving, he'll blow my head off. So,
oh my gosh.
At that point, it was more of a just, you know, just sit back and just kind of let the situation, you know, just take a course and just, you know, relax. Everything's going to be okay. That's kind of like the mindset I tried to keep throughout it.
Jalen, I'm so sorry that happened to you, and I can't imagine. I mean, it sounds like you had conversations maybe with your parents about what to do if this were to happen to you. Did you ever imagine that something like this would actually happen to you?
No, I always used to my parents used to make me sit down and have the conversation with me. It was kind of like, why do we have to have this conversation again? Looking back on it, I never really thought that I would have to use what they were saying or the tool that they were giving me. I never thought that those were actually coming handy for me, at least. And in that moment, I didn't even realize that what they had talked to me about years before, prior to, I was using those exact same tools to, you know, basically keep myself safe in that situation. So never really thought that I would have to use those, but.
And I understand that at some point during this incident, the police, it sounds like they realized that they had made a mistake. What was communicated to you about that?
I assume they made the realization when my coach and my bus driver kind of was able to get them to listen to them and kind of let them know. And they like looked at the bus, saw my EIU logo on my jacket. And kind of, you know, kind of put two and two together real fast. And then after that, the situation was still kind of weird. At that point, they told me they were arresting me for resisting arrest. And then once they said that, I didn't know what to think anymore. So I kind of just had to let it play out again. The situation kind of ended once my coach had her talk with one of the deputies or sheriffs and was able to, you know, he was able to understand fully, like, you know, they had the wrong guy and they finally released me out of the squad car, out of the handcuffs. But even after that, they still asked for a form of identification. And then once I gave them that, they just checked it and then they went on their way.
Did you, Jalen, did you ask who these officers were, what agencies they were representing?
So while I was in the back of the SUV, I did ask the officer who was in the SUV with me if I could have the badge number of the officer who made the comment to me while I was lying on the ground. But he never responded. Never really knew what agency or county these officers were from, besides just looking at the cars.
I'm speaking with Jalen Butler. He's a student and member of the swim team at Eastern Illinois University. I'd also like to point out that there's a fairly in-depth story about this incident from Barb Ikus with the Quad City Times. We'll tweet out a link to her story if you follow us at 21STShow. And now I want to bring another person into this conversation. Rachel Murphy is an attorney with the ACLU of Illinois. Rachel, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rachel, I understand that the ACLU has filed a lawsuit on Jalen's behalf. Can you explain what the lawsuit lays out?
Yeah. So, Jalen's case is just absolutely heartbreaking, and it's really infuriating to hear about what's happened to him. And so our lawsuit lays out a number of claims. We're alleging that he was falsely arrested, that he was subjected to excessive force, that he was subjected to excessive detention because they should have let him go immediately upon realizing they had the wrong person. And then it also lays out a number of state claims in addition to the constitutional claims.
And who is this lawsuit against? Who are the defendants in this case?
So the defendants are four individual officers from the Hampton Police Department, East Moline Police Department, Rock Island County Sheriff's Office, and then also two John Doe defendants who we currently don't know their identities or which agencies they were from.
Wow. So, Rachel, what do we know about why the police targeted Jalen that day? It seems like it came out of nowhere.
So we have some information about why the officers were in the area, but it still doesn't explain why they targeted Jalen in the way that they did and why they subjected him to such force and continued to detain him, you know, even after realizing they had the wrong person. So we really don't know why they decided to treat him the way that they did.
So it sounds like you do have some questions. What are you hoping that this legal process will help you uncover about this incident, Rachel?
We want to understand what happened, and we want to hold these officers accountable for what they've done to Jalen.
And we should note that we reached out to the Illinois State Police, the Rock Island County Sheriff's Office, and the Henry County Sheriff's Office for comment about this. As of this morning, we received a statement from Rock Island County Sheriff Jerry Bustos. It states that the two sheriff's deputies named in the lawsuit alleging excessive force in the February 2019 incident arrived after Jalen Butler had already been detained by the officers from other agencies. He said he's confident that the allegations against his deputies are, quote, without merit. And Rachel, you know, I'm curious why the ACLU of Illinois wanted to get involved in this case specifically.
I mean, the facts of this case are just awful. You know, Jalen had been doing nothing wrong. And then when the officers actually came up to him, he continued to comply with their orders. He didn't resist. So this is just a case of he did everything right, and they still treated him this way. So I think these kinds of interactions with police officers happen so frequently, but we don't hear about them. And it's fortunate that Jalen wasn't more seriously injured, but doesn't mean that he wasn't subjected to harm throughout this interaction. It doesn't mean that he's not been injured in some way. And I think that this kind of case draws attention to the harm of these police interactions, and especially the harm of having a gun pointed at you, because that is terrifying. And a lot of times that kind of interaction isn't even documented or recorded. So we aren't even aware of exactly the number of times somebody has a gun pointed at them by a police officer.
Jalen, I was wondering if you could kind of talk about how this whole experience has affected your life. It sounds extremely traumatic. What have been the consequences of it for you?
I'd say growing up, I've dealt with some traumatic experiences. I've had multiple life-threatening surgeries for a rare medical case that I have. So I've been in, you know, traumatic instances where I've had to kind of process, okay, well, this is really bad. This is what happens. But for this incident, I guess I tried to put on a brave front like I did with everything else. And with that being said, I pushed what had happened to me down and tried to bury it deep down. But eventually it just kind of ate me from the inside out, and it rose up and kind of unleashed. And I remember having classes the next day after the incident, and seeing the bruises on my wrist from the handcuffs and kind of just zoning out, losing track of time. And next thing I knew, the class was ending. I remember going to practices, not swimming well, getting mad. I remember my anger being really just through the roof, and I wasn't able to understand why. And then it kind of all clicked, and I had a huge breakdown in the summertime. I kind of let myself feel, you know, the events that had happened, and stopped trying to put on the brave front and understand that it's okay to not be okay. Mm. And I think the overall consequence from that incident was just kind of understanding that, you know, I didn't do anything wrong, but it's okay to, you know, feel saddened and angered and upset about what had happened.
Jalen, thank you so much for sharing that. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Practice is what's keeping me, keeping my spirits high. I love swimming. I've loved the water ever since I can remember. It was kind of like destiny for me to find swimming. So every time I hop in the water, it's always a smile on my face. So with this big conference championship meet coming up, I'm really excited and pumped and ready to go. So I'm in high spirits.
And Jalen, I first of all, I wish you the best of luck in that competition. But second of all, I'm curious, how has your team responded to this incident?
So during that night, it kind of hit them all really hard. I remember throughout the season, we always kind of talked and kind of tried to understand like the differences between both of our cultures, being Caucasian, African American. And it was interesting because most of them had never either seen an African American swimmer themselves, like in person.
Are you the only Black swimmer on the team?
Yes, I am. That night, it kind of all shocked them because, you know, you don't really see stuff like that in person, let alone it to happen to someone that you go a whole year getting very close with, training with, going through hard practices with. So it hit them. It hit them pretty hard. A lot of them were crying, very upset. And I remember once we got the bus back going, the energy was just completely shifted. You just kind of heard like sniffles, and it was just crying and just real quiet. And after about 10 minutes, I just couldn't take it, and I broke the silence and kind of tried to uplift their spirits and let them know that, you know, I was okay. They were okay. The situation's, you know, done and over with.
Thank you so much for sharing that with me, Jalen. I'm so happy to hear that you're doing okay now. I really wish you the best of luck in your swimming season.
Thank you.
That's Jalen Butler. He's a student at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. I'd also like to thank Rachel Murphy, attorney with ACLU of Illinois. Both of you, again, thank you so much for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. Once someone goes to prison for the first time, the odds of them going back depend a lot on the education and job training they receive while behind bars. But in Illinois, only a small percentage of inmates have access to educational opportunities. A big reason is long wait lists. Illinois Department of Corrections policy says that once a class is full, inmates are placed on the waiting list in order of their release date, with those getting out soonest receiving priority. Lee Gaines recently reported on this and other roadblocks to education in Illinois prisons for Illinois Newsroom. She joins us now in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Tim Barnett. He's a professor of English at Northeastern Illinois University and also co-founded the University Without Walls, a degree completion program at Stateville Prison in Crest Hill, Illinois. Thanks for being with us, Tim.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Lee, my first question is to you. How many prisoners are there in Illinois, and what percentage of them are able to get an education in prison?
So the prison population has actually been declining in Illinois. There are roughly about 40,000 people who are currently incarcerated in state facilities. And I don't have the percentage offhand, but it's very, very low if you're looking at attainment levels. So from the data that I could get that was verified by the Illinois Department of Corrections, about 160 or so people earned an associate's degree in fiscal year 2018, and about 723 people earned a GED. And so that's out of a total population of roughly 40,000.
Wow. And do you know the broad spectrum of what's available to them? I mean, you mentioned GED.
Yeah. So there's a number of programs that are available. So on the very basic level, you have adult basic education. And so that's for people who really need some help with primary and secondary classes. And then you also have the ability to study for your GED or your high school equivalency. And then as far as post-secondary programming goes, it's really kind of all over the map and really depends where you are in the prison system physically, like what facility are you located at. There are some facilities in the Chicago area, Stateville being one of them, that offers a number of college programs that are operated by private and public universities. Those are funded and really resource dependent on those universities. And so the people that are incarcerated up there have more access to programming than people who are incarcerated in some of the central and southern parts of the state where, you know, they might not have access to academic community college classes, or they might not have access to vocational classes, you know, depending on where they might be in the waiting list for such classes.
And speaking of such programs, Tim, you're a professor at Northeastern Illinois University. You also work with a program called University Without Walls at Stateville. Lee mentioned Stateville. Just give us a little background. Where is Stateville, for those of us who don't know, and what's it like there?
Stateville's in Crest Hill, Illinois, by Joliet. It's a maximum security prison. Up to about 8 or 9 years ago, they had a GED program, and they had several religious kinds of programs and other sorts of programs, but no higher ed education. And the first two in there were DePaul University with their Inside Out program and the Prison and Neighborhood Arts Project, of which I'm a part as well, which is a coalition of faculty and activists and academics from around the city. And we ran non-credited classes, still continue the non-credited program. And about 5 years ago, maybe six, North Park University became involved, and they have a few programs, including a master's program. And about 3 years ago, Northwestern University got involved as well, and they are also running a few programs. And so there's a lot of good work happening at Stateville.
Wow. And would you say there's a good smattering of courses from every different discipline that are that's available?
Yes. Early on, not so much. The Prison Neighborhood Arts Project, we focus on arts and humanities, and we've extended to social sciences. But since Northwestern's come in, I've heard more about chemistry and hard sciences and math. So I do think it's probably not fully balanced, but there's definitely more of a balance now, and more students have access to higher ed.
And what makes you eligible? What do you have to do to be eligible to take class at Stateville?
It sort of depends. Early on, so the Prison and Neighborhood Arts Project runs on its own kind of system. But we also obviously have to adapt to the IDOC system and Stateville in particular, so that we accepted classes into college-level classes that were run not for credit. Pretty much any student who applied who was interested, they had to write a sort of letter indicating their interest and their background. But we were open to people who had GEDs or high school degrees and people who were not. We also have, through Northeastern Illinois University, the University Without Walls program, which graduated six students with a Bachelor of Arts degree last May. Those students, of course, had to have a high school diploma or a GED. And the other programs, which are offering credited classes, I believe these days they would, you know, require a GED, high school diploma. I think most of the programs require interviews. It's a fairly extensive process.
Lee, what have you found about what it takes to be eligible to take any kinds of educational classes in prison?
So there's a distinction, I think, between what Tim is describing mm-hmm. and what the Department of Corrections is offering. So, you know, as Tim mentioned, there are, you know, Northeastern, there's Northwestern, and here actually in Champaign-Urbana, we have the University of Illinois, which goes into Danville Correctional Center and offers accredited classes to a certain group of incarcerated men. They're a very select group. So that's separate from what DOC offers, which is they contract with community colleges across the state, primarily with one, Lakeland Community College, and they pay people to come in and teach certain vocational classes. But it's actually up to the community college to decide if they want to offer academic community college courses. The Department of Corrections isn't going to pay for that. And there's not a lot of educators. There's a little over 100 total in the system currently. And like I said, there's 40,000 people who are currently incarcerated. So the way it works for DOC with that type of programming is that usually they're filled to capacity because there's the demand, it exceeds the ability to offer these courses. And so you get placed on a waiting list, and you end up being placed on the waiting list based on your release date. So that means that people who are closer to their release date are going to be prioritized for that program, which, you know, makes a lot of sense from a logical point of view. However, what that actually ends up meaning in reality is that people with longer sentences can sit on these waiting lists for years and in the meantime have access to really nothing in the way of education.
So it sounds like it's either you have to be close to your release date or happen to be in a prison that has one of these wonderful programs from a private school that's come in.
Exactly. Or you have to be in a prison where a lot of the people in that facility have similarly long sentences. And then maybe at that point you can get access to a program. But if you're in a facility where, you know, let's say you're serving a 20-year sentence and the guy next to you is serving 10 months, that guy's going to be fast-tracked for the program.
And Tim, I'm just wondering, what are you teaching in prison?
So the University Without Walls program is a non-traditional degree completion program. And we have requirements based on, it's been around about 50 years, since about the 70s. And it takes into account students' experiences and the learning that they've obtained wherever they've obtained it. So that PNEP classes, for example, which have been taught by accredited professors, often internationally known professors, at the college level, but not for credit, are able to be applied towards a University Without Walls degree because it includes experiential and other kinds of learning as well. I'm an English professor primarily, and I've kind of helped oversee the University Without Walls program for the last 4 years or so. And so I tend to focus on literature, writing, and those kinds of things. And I just kind of, as I said, administer the program is probably mostly what I do.
Mm-hmm. Lee, you spoke. Yeah.
Just quickly. In regards to what Lee had mentioned, there is, an important distinction that the community colleges headed by Lakeland, you know, have a connection with the state that the universities do not. And I wanted to add that when Governor Rauner was in office, that many of the community colleges, in fact, were unable to continue with their commitment to education in the prisons. And the state, you know, dropped funding, and part of the problem with funding up our way is that universities like Northeastern Illinois University, which caters to working class students of color, immigrants, and others, we are still suffering from the budget. And so one of the big issues with prison education is money. And there's a lot of talk about we want to support education, but many of the public universities are broke and IDOC is broke. And so there's really an important need to figure out the financial situation.
Lee, you mentioned the long wait list for prisoners, but you actually spoke with an inmate who transferred for better education options. Let's hear what he had to say.
I'm still on a waiting list for it. February or March, it'll make 3 years for me being on a waiting list and nothing.
Yeah, so that's Ralph Gray. And what he's talking about there is he's on a waiting list for an auto body class. So he was initially in Western Illinois prison, and he was able to take some academic community college classes up there through Lakeland. And he said he was about 16 credits shy of receiving his associate's degree. And this is a guy who now is 25. He was incarcerated when he was 18 years old. He's 7 years through a 20-year sentence. And so he said his quality of life at Western really wasn't great. He was only allowed to leave his cell for about an hour and a half every day, despite the fact that he, you know, was getting an education. But they didn't have this vocational class that he wanted to take. He really wanted to take an auto body class. He felt like that might make him a more attractive employee once he's released. And so he requested a transfer to Graham Correctional Center, which was a lower security prison, and he received it. But what he didn't realize is he wasn't aware of this policy that prioritizes people who are closer to their out dates. So when he got there and wanted to take this class, he was basically told, you know, good luck. You're going to be at the very bottom of this wait list for a very long time. And as he says in that clip, you know, it's been 3 years so far.
Mm. And he has no idea when he'll be
able
to take the class.
He has no idea. And, you know, there's no, in the meantime, he can't complete his associate's degree. And so what he said to me is, you know, his last resort really in this situation, I think what a lot of people who are motivated like him, because he's really motivated to get an education, is he's going to have to pay for correspondence courses. Mm. And when I say he, that means his family. And
right.
He's very lucky that he has a family, I think, that's willing to do that.
Right. And a lot just don't. Do you know how the availability of education, or in this case, the lack thereof, affects recidivism? Is it possible to tease those things out?
Yeah, there's actually been some research done on that, and research is continuing on that. The RAND Corporation, which is this nonpartisan think tank, did a study about that a number of years ago. And what they found was that for every dollar that a correctional system or a state correctional system spends on education inside its prison, they save $5 on recidivism costs. They believe there's a very strong connection between you know, the likelihood that someone will return to prison is very much decreased if they have access to an education while they are incarcerated. So I think, you know, people that get an associate's degree, the chance that they'll recidivate decreases. And then as you go up the scale to bachelor's and even a graduate degree, I mean, it gets even, you know, slimmer and slimmer after that. So there is, according to the research so far, a pretty significant connection.
Huh. And now I know that other states do this a lot better, especially places like California. They've got San Quentin that has a myriad of programs. And I'm just wondering why Illinois cannot get this done a little bit better.
So California is an interesting case. I would say they do it the best. And that's because of, you know, legislation that they had passed in 2014. San Quentin at that time, I think, might have been the only prison that had this type of programming in it. And what they ended up doing through this legislation was cutting down some red tape, some bureaucracy. So essentially, the law allows community colleges to come into the prisons, teach face-to-face classes, and then they can be reimbursed from the state for teaching those classes. And so a lot of these community colleges actually had declining enrollment. So this was kind of an incentive for them to go into the prisons, teach these students, and also receive funding for doing so from the state. And so California went from, you know, having some college programming in only two of its 35 facilities to now having college programming in 34 of 35 facilities. And there's an extraordinary demand. And what I was told by the someone who works over in that prison system, Brant Choate, he's the director of their programming services, he told me, you know, this is really, it's not just that they're getting an education and that's going to make them less likely to recidivate. It's also changing the culture of the prison itself. It's leading to less destructive behaviors. It's making the jobs of the staff at the prison easier. It's having these other kind of less quantifiable benefits in terms of what it is like to be inside that prison facility.
Well, speaking of money, and as you mentioned, Ralph may have to pay for his own, and
yes,
he's willing to. We have another clip from Ralph, and he's talking about that.
I think it's most important for me to continue to strive, irregardless of whether IDOC is offering it to me or I have to pay out of my own pocket to make sure that I obtain the education that's necessary.
Yeah, that's going to be a real stretch for some inmates. Tim, how heavy a lift is this for the people and the advocates who want to see the system changed?
It's pretty heavy. It's nice to see that there seems to be a shift in public opinion and that prison reform and hopefully radical change is actually or seems to be, you know, on the minds of people in different ways than it was 10 years ago. And it's interesting as well that this is one of the few bipartisan issues. And I think there are definitely distinctions and certainly not everyone has the same idea of what it means to reform prisons or to change them dramatically. But I think that there is change. The private universities, the state universities that are working on their own, we've been raising money through grants. We've been raising money through private foundations. We've had fundraisers. We've had a lot of volunteer activity. So the dollars sort of spent that way have, you know, been fairly great over the last 8, 9, 10 years. So it's, you know, there's definitely a lot to be changed, and a lot of it has to do with public attitude. But the heartening part is, I think, that is starting to change.
Lee, last question. Has the idea of rehabilitation kind of died along with the budget for inmate education?
I don't think so, because I actually...
I mean, for the state.
For the state.
Funded.
I mean... So here's the thing. I think Tim is right. I think that we're starting to see conditions inside prisons being talked about in a way that it wasn't talked about 10 years ago. There is this focus on mass incarceration, and he's right. It is a bipartisan issue in that I think both Democrats and Republicans agree that the way that we do prisons in this country just isn't working for anyone. And you can come to that argument from a humanitarian perspective, but you can also come to that argument from
economic,
a fiscal,
yeah,
perspective.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So what it really is going to take, it's going to take investment, I think, though, on the part of the state. And the people that control the powers of the purse are our state officials, our elected officials. So it's going to really be up to them whether or not they want to follow in a state like California's lead.
Lee Gaines is the education reporter at Illinois Newsroom and WILL. Tim Barnett is a professor of English at Northeastern Illinois University. Thank you guys both for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. Finding the right care for a parent or loved one as they age can be difficult. But for LGBT individuals needing care, that process can be even more daunting. A 2018 AARP survey found that more than a third of LGBT seniors were concerned that they would have to hide their identities in order to find suitable housing as they age. And at least 60% of LGBT seniors said they were concerned about neglect, harassment, and abuse. Now the Howard Brown Health Center and Mennonite College of Nursing at Illinois State University are sponsoring a workshop aimed at addressing this. The free program will provide nurses with more resources on the specific challenges that LGBT seniors can face, as well as strategies for what more comprehensive care looks like for members of the queer community. We'll have more information about that workshop up on our website at 21stshow.org for anyone interested. But in the meantime, I'm joined on the line by Cecilia Hardacker. She's the Director of Education at Howard Brown Health Center in Chicago. Cecilia, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Gwen. My pleasure.
So I want to get to the workshop in just a few minutes, but first I want to start with some basics to talk more broadly about LGBT health and healthcare in general. What do we know about some of the challenges that people of all ages face in the queer community when it comes to getting proper health care?
There are a number of things that we can look at generally and broadly across all the communities. Obviously, each community under the multi-letter acronym have their own unique individual needs. But generally across, we can very clearly say that there are increased health disparities for multiple reasons: a lack of access to care, general fear of discrimination, and people who've experienced stigma creates barriers for people to come in for healthcare, honestly, across the lifespan, but more intensely in a lot of ways for older adults.
And what about specifically LGBT elders as opposed to, I mean, what are they facing that members of the heterosexual elderly community are not?
So there's a lot of things that are very similar, but the differences, I would say, have more to do with access, a lot of it having to do with a lack of community. Older adults are much more likely to live on their own and be isolated. They're much less likely to have family members, their own biological children in many cases. And many of the older adults now are estranged from their families, so their support systems are really limited. And if we start talking about services that are available for folks, those are also limited, services that are really tailored and that make people who are part of the older LGBTQ community comfortable. That makes things really challenging. So in your opener, when you talked about people hiding their identities and potentially going back in the closet when seeking that kind of long-term care, that's absolutely true. And that's one of the biggest fears that people that are in the LGBTQ community have.
And what are some of the consequences we're seeing when people aren't able to get the mental or physical care they need as they age, especially?
Well, being housebound or isolated increases the risk for so many things. That kind of social isolation increases risk of falls, depression, substance use. There's many, many things that can be attributed to people really trying to hole up at home. Everybody wants to age at home. You know, they want to live their best life as long as they can and to be as independent as they can.
Sure.
But the situation for older LGBT people does tend to be more dire in a lot of situations.
So you and Howard Brown Health have established the HEAL program, otherwise known as the Health Education About LGBT Elders Program, to help address some of the gaps in care that we've been talking about. There will actually be a HEAL workshop at the end of March for nurses in the Bloomington Normal area, and we'll have more information about that on our website for anyone interested. But as I understand it, the whole idea behind HEAL has to do with educating caregivers and healthcare workers about culturally competent care. Can you walk us through what that means and what it actually looks like in practice?
Absolutely. So you might be surprised, Gwen, to know that for the vast majority of nursing colleges in the United States, there is no requirement to teach any health education that is related to the LGBTQ community. So
that is really surprising, I have to say.
To this day, it sort of blows my mind. I began my nursing career many, many years ago and came back with a focus on education within the last 10 years. And I was very excited to start taking more classes to bone up on things, and discovered that there still was no education about it. So when I began my work here at Howard Brown, I was hired specifically to deliver the curriculum that you mentioned, health education about LGBT elders. And that was developed through government funding to address the very real needs and vulnerabilities experienced by people who are older in the communities. And it was focused on nurses and really letting them know the issues that that group had, let them know what best practices and things that they could employ in their daily practice that could be really beneficial to people as they age. And it covers a lot. It's a 6-hour curriculum. It can get longer than that, depending upon how things go when we're having the session, covering everything from the basics of who people are in the communities, the history that they've gone through, what their experience has been like growing up in the United States, in the last 50 years. You think of there's some tremendous changes that have happened in that period of time. We talk about the sex and sexuality of older adults. We talk about legal challenges and really financial limitations that can be put on people when they're older, and that makes things even harder for them. We spend quite a lot of time talking about transgender older adults. That's a group of people that experience disparities even more so, and even less information is available for people to know about them. And then we talk about HIV and aging. As people are living long, healthy lives, being HIV positive, there's an entire cohort of people who are aging and who will require some different care as they get older. And certainly, the long-term care systems that we have in place now have also never really been trained on how to care for folks
right.
who are living with HIV. So it's very comprehensive.
Right. I mean, the culturally competent care that people need to provide have to take into account all of the backgrounds and all of the social, emotional things everybody's dealing with.
Exactly.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Gwen Maxey. My guest is Cecilia Hardacker. She's the Director of Education at Howard Brown Health Center. Cecilia's been telling us more about the workshops and education that her organization has been providing to nurses who are interested in caring for the aging LGBT individuals. So, this might be the first generation, because of the activism in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, are we starting to see the first wave of older LGBT people who've been out for the majority of their lives? And I'm wondering if you anticipate that we'll start seeing a need for more culturally competent care in the future, because if they've been out all their lives, it might just be different when they age.
I think that's absolutely right. You think about the boomer generation and the lives that they've lived. This is a group of people that have in fact been activists, have in fact been consumers. I always try to let people know that the folks that are getting older now are very used to living their lives the way they've lived them and have very little interest in changing them. So think about someone who has, that very strong consumer attitude that I can get what I need, and I have every anticipation I'm going to continue to do that as I'm older. So when we talk about the limitations of long-term care and nursing homes and those types of things, there are places where people are developing their own ways of living. They're building cooperatives, they're developing real estate so that they can have places where people can live that are like-minded and part of the communities. And those are slowly growing across the country. There's one here in Chicago. We're going to see that change. I think you're absolutely right that the group of people that are aging now are going to be, let's just say, more demanding. They're going to want what they need.
Well,
they're
right.
Very clear about their needs. And
yeah.
Work hard to get them.
Well, it begs another question, because as this aging population swells, the resources are scarcer and scarcer, and we're getting more and more people who are, you know, we've got the baby boomers in a bubble getting older. I'm wondering if you're worried about the resources for the LGBT community, because we're worried about that for sort of everybody.
Well, I was going to say exactly that. We're worried about that for everybody. The number of available senior services are stretched thin now. So that's why I think we're really looking at any and all initiatives that focus on what we can do intergenerationally. That's been those have been some really fascinating ideas that people have been working on in terms of how to find support for older adults that maybe don't need that greatest need of care, but, you know, they need to have some sort of connection to community and help from people every now and then. So some of those ideas that we've been investigating and hearing more and more about, certainly in the LGBTQ community, are really exciting. And those might be things that can fill in those gaps mm-hmm. where we really don't have all the support that we need.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've been hearing a lot about the shortage of healthcare workers for elderly populations in general, but I'd imagine that issue is magnified when it comes to that workforce also being trained to meet the needs of LGBT elderly. Is that something you're running into?
It's honestly, it's across the board. At this point, when we go and do education with at hospitals or nursing schools, whatever the case may be, I always ask how many people are interested in geriatrics and are interested in working in geriatric nursing, and maybe one out of 30 hands will go up.
Wow.
And then I remind them, you will, unless you're going to go watch little people be delivered into the world, you're all going to have patients who are older. So you really should get that in your mind, because that's what's going to happen. We're not training people to be prepared for the fact that they're going to have patients who are older and potentially have more needs. And that's across the board, whether that person is part of the LGBTQ community or not. So it is absolutely a shortage. And that's why we're so happy when we can go out and talk to nursing students, because we can tap into that new generation of caregivers and let them know, hey, you're going to have these folks. We really want you to know as much as you can. We want, because you didn't get this in school, and we're trying to make up for that deficit.
What else do you think needs to be done for these communities? We don't have a lot of time, so if you can answer briefly, I'd appreciate it. What else would you like to see?
Oh, that's a really difficult question to answer. I would like to see so much. I guess primarily I would like to see more education. I mean, I hate to go to my fallback, but honestly, if we could take the time to make sure that nurses were educated, doctors only get an average of about 6 hours total in their entire medical education about LGBT health issues, and an even smaller fraction of that is about older adults.
Wow.
Essentially across the board, all the, you know, allied healthcare professions, they just don't get the training that they need. And so, you know, that really is incumbent upon academic institutions to really step up and make sure that this is something, education that people get. My education department is 3.5 people, and we go to as many places as we can, but it's just not enough. You know, it's not as sustainable as we would like it to be. So we are, one of the things that we do at Howard Brown is we've got this an education symposium that we do every year that's a couple days long, where we invite people from around the Midwest to come and learn as much as they can about many things, but includes an entire track about older adults to let people know, you know, that there are special needs and things that they need to learn. And it's just harder and harder to be able to do that. But there are multiple conferences, multiple resources across the country that really do focus on older adults.
Great.
We just need more. And the answer to the original question is we just need more of everything.
That's Cecilia Hardacker. She's Director of Education at Howard Brown Health Center. We'll tweet out more information about the free HEAL workshop that will be open to nurses in the Bloomington Normal area at the end of March. You can find us at 21STShow on Twitter. Cecilia, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Julian Haida. Eunice Alpesan is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Gwen Macsai. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.